It's ad break time. I'm proud to announce that Beyond Solitaire podcast is sponsored by Central Michigan University's Center for Learning Through Games and Simulations. And as usual, they're up to some amazing things. Their next game, Hydrologic Cycle, is scheduled to come to Kickstarter on March 26th. CLGS also continues to offer classes in partnership with Gen Con. The next course, Jason Fury's Crowdfunding with Confidence, starts May 6th and will teach you all about board games and crowdfunding. Go check it out. Also, I'll include a final plug for myself. If you like the show and want to support it, you can do so by going to patreon.com/beyondsolitaire. Thanks to listeners like you, I've been able to keep upgrading my equipment, subscribing to StreamYard, and more. But for now, let's get on with the show. Hey, gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and I'm here on the pod with Jason Carr. He is the Director of Game Development at GMT. How you doing, Jason?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's fun to finally have you on. So you actually do a lot of things for GMT. How did you get started with them, and then how did you end up as the Director of Game Development?
Yeah, I mean, I've told that story a couple times, and so I'll keep it on the shorter side so I don't bore people to death. But I've been with GMT for going on 8 years now. Started out doing development for the Coin series. So the very first thing that I did as sort of a standalone development project was working on Gandhi with Bruce Mansfield and Scott Mansfield. And that was really fun and got me kind of in the door. But if I'm really being honest, the thing that made it possible for me to do game development was working with Mike Berticelli on Tank Duel. Mike is a good friend, and he's a way better game developer than I am. And that was his first published game design. And he brought me under his wing and kind of carried me along, showed me the ropes, taught me what to do. So I'm listed as the developer on that, but Mike probably did 85% of the development on that game. and Gandhi was my first like standalone thing. So once that shipped and it was well received, and it was clear that I had done, you know, finished a project and actually shipped something, Gene and I started talking about doing more, and one thing led to another, and I ended up kind of running the development show.
Oh, that's awesome. So I guess you mentioned it takes a lot of training, I guess, to become the developer that you are today. What does it take to actually be a good developer? What are the things that you had to learn to do to get it right?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I don't know if everyone really understands or even thinks about game development the same way. So for GMT, when we talk about game development, we mean this interesting mixture of product development, where you're thinking about what the game should be and representing kind of GMT's interest in the game. And then project management, right? You're just keeping all of the different parts moving. So what's going on with playtesting, what's going on with the rule book, what's going on with the design elements if you ask the designer to redesign something. Art is a big part of that, so coordinating with the art department to make sure that art is done well and right. If we work with an editor, coordinating with the editor. And then there's a certain aspect of design sensibility that's associated with it as well, like being able to play a game and say, this isn't fun and here's why, or playtesters are complaining about something, but they're not complaining about the cause, they're complaining about a symptom, and understanding how to fix that and make suggestions and work with a designer to fix games and make them more fun. There's a little bit more of art than science in that world, and it can be really difficult to explain it, but you know it when you see it.
Oh no, you know it when you see it, that's tough.
It's the worst answer.
Of course. No, it's okay. That's what we're all about on this podcast. So when you talk about all those different aspects of the work, I think, well, what do you find to be the most difficult aspect?
For me, it's the writing. So I don't hate writing. I mean, I was a philosophy major in undergrad, and I don't think anybody who hates writing goes and studies philosophy, because you do a lot of it. And over the years, I've written lots of articles for Inside GMT and written several rule books from scratch. But taking what somebody else's intent is and figuring out how to express it in plain English that is as unambiguous as possible is never easy. It doesn't matter how good you are at writing. And so I think that can turn into a little bit of a slog sometimes. And so, working with designers, sometimes it's easier for them not to do the writing. It's easier for them to explain, sit down, show you how the game works, and for the developer to do the actual work of writing the rule books. Other times the designers bring you great rule books that are really easy to publish, with minimal changes. Those are great. I like those. But no matter what the circumstance is, writing is always a really big challenge.
So it sounds like it's not just the writing itself. It's the learning how to express somebody else's intent.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things is that I've been doing some design work myself. So Jason Matthews and I have a game in the Twilight Struggle family on South Asia. And working on the rule book for that has been much easier. We're not really writing rule book yet, but writing out the rules, the rule changes for that has been a lot easier because I'm not playing a middleman between the designer and the gamer. I am the designer. And so my intent is much easier to express. The hard part there is getting Jason to do anything sensible because he just does whatever he wants. He's out of control.
Yes, I can see that being the case. So does that mean that you think it's actually easier to design than to develop?
I think they're apples and oranges. I mean, design is about, I think design when it's done well is taking a thesis and expressing it through game. So if I was taking an example, I'll take Gandhi as the example. The thesis of Gandhi, as I understand it from Bruce, is that there's an analogy between insurgency and nonviolent resistance that can be expressed through a study of the similarities and the differences between the two. And he's building on the work of Erica Chenoweth and her research into nonviolent movements. And when he read her book, he immediately said, wow, the coin series expresses this really well. So his thesis was brought to the coin series. He used the coin series to express it. And that's just a very different type of mental exercise than doing development, where I was asking myself questions like, well, do these mechanisms actually reflect that thesis? Would a gamer who's coming and sitting down at the table be able to understand the levers that are available to them in the game system and play the game in a way that was an expression of the designer's intent? And then there's all the other things that are on top of that. Like, is this game learnable? Is it playable? Is it fun? Is it balanced? And so I don't think that development is harder than design, but I do think that they occupy two very different and distinct mental spaces. And that can be a bit of a challenge when designers try to do development, because I think that they're used to being in a design space and moving into a development space can be hard.
Oh, that's interesting. So since you moved from development to design, do you think that transition has been different for you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that I have a tendency to put the cart before the horse. And so I start thinking about development problems way before I've solved the design problems. And there is a sequence to that. You have to know what your thesis is before you can refine it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I've said that to some students about their papers in the past.
Right.
So what do you think that an ideal relationship, I guess at least for you, I know it's everybody's different, between a developer and a designer would look like?
Yeah, so I wrote an article about this for C3i, and I think it was issue 35. And my argument is that the designer brings the thesis, and the designer brings the intent, and the job of the developer is to refine that thesis and to make sure that its expression isn't sullied by the other elements of the game. So that is to say, you might have a great thesis, but the rulebook is unintelligible. Did your thesis get communicated? Probably not. You might have a great thesis, but the game is unbalanced. Well, there are cases that I know of where the imbalance is part of the thesis. The one game that comes to mind most clearly is John Paniski's game on Vietnam Hearts and Minds. He says right in the design notes that the game is designed in such a way that after a certain point, the U.S. is not going to win. And that was an intentional design choice. Isn't going to win is too strong, but is unlikely to win. But usually imbalance in a game, and I guess we could have a whole long conversation about what game balance actually is without any settling on anything. But at least as I think about it, it doesn't necessarily mean equal win. It means the model is being expressed, the thesis is being expressed. And so
right.
In that world where John wanted his game to be more difficult for the US player to win the longer the war drug on. If the game wasn't working that way, that would be a development problem. That would be something where a developer should have pointed that out and corrected it with the designer at some point in the process. I could think of a dozen different ways this could come through in the art, in the language used in the cards. I did competitive speech and debate when I was in college. And one of the things that we would often do is argue about the language that was used in a specific debate case, and argue that the language that was used actually went against the point that was being argued. And that is one of the things that I think about a lot when we make games, is the whole complete package forming an argument for the player to work with.
So this kind of leads me into, I guess, kind of where I wanted to spend a lot of our time, which is when you find that a game is not expressing its argument well and you're in charge of its development, who actually does the fixing, and how do you negotiate that? Because at what point are you putting words in the designer's mouth versus correcting what they said?
Yeah, I mean, huge challenge. And I think the answer is as nuanced as the problem. So just as there are 100 different ways that a game could accidentally veer from its thesis or contradict its thesis or fail to express its thesis, there's 100 different remedies for that problem. I think at its core, every solution to that has to start with a relationship. And I think where a lot of these games get off track is when you find that games have been thrown over the wall to the publisher. And sometimes that's because that's how the publisher works and that's their desire. And sometimes that's because the designer doesn't want to be involved in development. At GMT, we want our designers involved all the way until the game goes to the printer. So, Mark Herman was involved in Rebel Fury until the day that that thing went to the printer. And he and I were talking on the phone every day for the last couple of weeks, just making sure, yes, that every detail was correct. But also, does this look the way that you want it to look to convey what you're trying to convey? And is this language communicating what you want to communicate about the period, about the game, about the time? So, Gene likes to say that we like games, but we love people. And that is how we solve this problem. There are games that have been brought to me that have had a thesis. We've run into problems with that thesis. I've gone to the designer and said, hey, I don't know what to do here. What do you want to do? And they've said, I have no idea. I can't solve this problem. And then it becomes a collaborative problem-solving exercise where, yeah, maybe I'm just as involved in design or more involved than they are in trying to solve that problem. But I never take that problem and make it mine. It's never my thesis. It's never my game. It's always about telling the story the designer wanted to tell, because ultimately that's the thing that we agreed to publish, was that designer's view. And so that is a little bit of a non-answer to your question, for sure. But I think it also reflects the kind of games that we tend to make, because we don't make games that are just trinkets. Like, our games, generally speaking, are trying to tell a story. And that story is a particular one that the designer wants to tell. And even our Euro games, like, take Dominant Species. Dominant Species is still a particular type of experience. Chad was opinionated about how that game was supposed to work. And so it would never work for a third party to step in and take that away from him and make it into a house brand or a particular flavor of game. It would lose the essence of what made that game special. So I'm not saying that can't work for other publishers. I know other publishers that are great, that have house standards, and they take games and they publish them to that set of standards. There's a market for that. There's a purpose for that. It's just not what we do.
Your game is a trinket. You heard it here.
Yes, every game that we don't publish is a trinket. I'm sure that'll get, I'm sure somebody will snip that out of this interview and
that's going on TikTok.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I'm playing. I might leave it in just because it's funny, but yeah. No, this is a polite, rational conversation, everyone. So this also kind of leads to, you know, if you're trying to help bring somebody else's thesis to life, how do you deal with your own, I guess, opinions about and reactions to that thesis?
Yeah, I don't think this is any different than editing. So as an editor, right, you can never not bring yourself to the text to some degree. And there might be that there is text that you simply can't edit because your opinion about it is too difficult to set aside, right? And so editorial bias is real. It exists. It's also a good thing. That editorial bias can sometimes help you check back some of the things that might be present in a text that would otherwise mar an argument. It's where you get to look and find people's blind spots. And I think that's 100% true in game development. The simplest example of that is a rule that seems completely clear to one person may be completely confusing to another. And as an editor, I want to bring that perspective. As a developer, I want to bring that thinking. So to that end, I actually do reading. When I pick up a new game, when I started working on Fall of Saigon, I asked Mark and Volko for a reading list. And I said, what do I need to read? And I read Black April by Veith. And I read, I had never read Fire in the Lake by Francis Fitzgerald. So I read that. And I read Max Hastings' Vietnam and Epic Tragedy. And I didn't want to work on the game without having the base context to be able to interact with the arguments the designers were making. And so that informed the design of that game. I think Mark Herman's talked about this before, but like he had the idea for how the Paris Peace Accords process in that game should work. He knew he wanted it to be a certain process that you went through, and he knew what he wanted the steps to be. But the particular rewards or punishments that happened based on the different outcomes of that were completely changed from his intent by the time the game was published. And they didn't come from him. They came from Joe Dewhurst and Steven Rangazis and myself playing the game over and over and over again and going back to Mark and saying, here's what we think provides the correct incentive. And then he would come back and say, well, I agree with you about this, but I disagree with you about that. And so then we would take that intent back and we would internalize it. We'd play again, play more. And we'd come back and say, okay, we understand what you're intending it to do. Our experience is that the reward you're giving has the opposite effect to what you want, or it has an orthogonal effect to what you want, or has no effect. And that's how we started to solve the problems that popped up because of this novel thing being bolted onto an existing game. Super hard problem space, by the way. And I was talking to Mark last week, and he brought this up as an example of kind of how good development is collaborative with a designer, and it's an exchange of ideas back and forth, not just him giving us something and we polish it and put it out there into the world.
It also sounds like development is a we sort of affair. So how often are you the sole dev on various projects? And then how often are you working with the team? Because you mentioned Joe and Steven, like, you know, who is typically working on games with you? And then how do y'all negotiate that aspect of development?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it, again, depends on the project. But we are moving more and more towards a model where we want to have lots of eyes on every game that comes through. So I don't want to assign a project to somebody and they go off with that project and disappear and then come back and say, it's ready to go to the printer. Here we go. I much prefer that we have games with two or three people who are passing the game around. And the most common way that happens is that we involve other gamers in testing. So Steven is one of the people who tests a lot of games because he's good friends with some of the people who do development for us. NB, Non-Breaking Space, does a lot of testing for us. A lot of the people who do that are designers in their own right because they tend to have a mind to think about games, but everybody brings something different to the table. So somebody like Steven is great at thinking about models. And so if I have a game that's model heavy and is really trying to make a statement about something, I always want his opinion. Like, he very likely will be able to see what that designer is doing much more quickly than other people, because he's trained how to think about those models. And I think that that's Kai Jensen does a lot of that for us, looks at games, thinks about them. She has her own point of view, and it's definitely different than mine. And that's awesome, because it means that we're seeing different things. We're seeing different possibilities about the game. So I try to make it much more collaborative. When it comes to, though, like, okay, this rule book needs to be rewritten, that's like a one-person job. It needs to have a single voice through it. And so the writing might be done by one person, and then it's edited by somebody else, and then it's proofread by other people, and then the game is blind tested and played. And that's where many hands make light work, just to be honest. And that's why we're really focusing on building a team instead of getting like one person and dumping everything on them.
Nice. So you've also kind of mentioned development and playtesting kind of in the same phrasing pretty often. So what is the relationship between, I mean, obviously a developer needs to play a game a lot in order to, you know, get to where they feel comfortable commenting on it and developing it. But, you know, who are you playtesting with at various stages, and what does playtesting mean at various points in the process?
Yeah. So I think of playtesting as four distinct things. So there's playtesting as a developer, where you are validating the thesis, and you might see something that doesn't line up with your expectations, and then you're validating alternatives for a designer. So let me think of an example of this. One example of validating a thesis would be when we were playtesting Red Dust Rebellion. So Jay, the designer, gave us a game. He told us what he wanted it to say. As we started internally testing it and, I guess, pressure testing his thesis, it became clear that a couple of the mechanisms did not say what he wanted them to say. And so Adam, the developer, didn't just go back to him and say, this doesn't say what you wanted to say. He sat down with the game and worked through alternatives and went back and presented a range of possibilities. We could do it this way. We could do it this way. We could do it this way. Which one do you think suits you the best? And I think in that example, it's been a little while since we were actually doing active design on that, but I'm pretty sure that Jay actually came up with like a fourth option that none of us had talked about. But that dialogue was really important to getting his thesis right. And so that kind of internal development testing is one thing that I mean by playtesting. Then there's testing with like a broader audience, still for the sake of making sure that the game tells the story that we wanted to tell, that it's fun, that it's playable. And that's what we do with our kind of broad playtesting groups. So we have something internally that we're really happy with. We put a note in the newsletter saying, hey, we would love to get more people to play the game. Usually in that world, we're testing something like a bunch of scenarios, and we're testing to make sure the scenarios are complete. You know, they have all the instructions you need to set them up and play them. We're testing to make sure they're fun, they're relatively balanced, things like that. But at that point, we're pretty confident that the core gameplay loop, that it tells the story we want it to tell, that it's fun to play. And what we're doing in this second phase is kind of tweaking it. The third phase of testing is really centered around polish. So in this world, we're doing things like, okay, we have a solitaire bot. Got to test that and make sure it's working. Sometimes developing the solitaire bot turns up problems with the game. That's become increasingly a tool that we use, is when we design a solo system, a lot of times the solo system actually shows us stuff in the game that was not working the way it was intended to. And so we can fix those things. We're doing testing on any of those kinds of tweaks and changes. Fine-tuning balance happens here. So this is where, like, the game, a coin game, the game might be almost completely done, but we're still asking ourselves, like, should this victory condition be at 28 or 30? And how do we decide which one to put it on?
How do you decide which one to put it on?
divination, like, there's really not a good answer. A lot of it is feel. A lot of it is, there is a math component to it, because a lot of these victory conditions are actually, if you look at the condition and then you look at the board and you figure out what the maximum value is, you'll start to see, oh, all of these are 90% of the maximum value. So sometimes there's math involved. Sometimes it is just gut feel. Like, we don't have the ability to play test those games to the degree that we could get statistically significant information about where the victory condition should be. That's just the reality of it. So sometimes those things do need to be tweaked post-publication. I can only think of one game where we've changed victory conditions post-publication. So that's, I guess, a good track record, actually. and then the last kind of testing is what we call like blind testing, which is where we take the final set of components, the final rules, and we give them to somebody and ask them to play the game and tell us what they found. And this is really kind of much more focused on errata elimination, like making sure that there are no mistakes in the game, that it's playable out of the box. At that point, we are very, very rarely finding any gameplay stuff or any kind of change in the user experience or the usability or the components themselves. I mean, obviously, if those things come up at that point, we fix them. But we're really laser focused in that on, is this a playable game? Is somebody going to be able to pick this up and actually learn it and play it if they buy it? Because we don't, the last thing we would ever want is somebody to give us their money and then like, well, I feel like I got a game that I can't play.
Yeah. So speaking of, you mentioned, you know, you can't get statistically significant victory conditions. I was going to go this direction. So let's be real. GMT makes some chonky games.
Yeah.
Y'all have some very long scenarios. You know, some of y'all's games are deeply intimidating in terms of how long they are. It's a commitment. And, you know, that doesn't stop me from being a fan. But how do you test that? Seriously, like how much testing does it really get? And as a developer, you know, are you winging it on some of those scenarios or have you really gone through every single one?
So as a developer, I am going to make sure that every scenario is playable. And so I'm taking a step back. So these bigger games, I'm taking a step back and I'm asking myself, how could I verify that this game is in a good state? And the answer to that almost always comes back to what I said earlier, that we have we make games that have theses. And that means that they have models that underlie them.
Right.
And so for us, testing is very often about the model and making sure the model is good. And then scenarios become a set of inputs that generate a set of outputs. And we, if we've tested the model thoroughly, we can predict what we think those outputs should be. And as we play through the scenarios, we can check and say, are these outputs corresponding to what we expected them to be based on the inputs? So for a game like a coin game, yes, all the coin game scenarios are played by I played every scenario in Fall of Saigon, including the combined scenario. Joe played every scenario in Sovereign of Discord, including the full crazy campaign. Now, did we play those enough to get statistically significant information? No. But we knew that the underlying model was solid because we had done the testing on the model. And also we were leveraging Fire in the Lake, which is a known quantity. For a new game that's super long, and I'm going to pick like the worst one, right? So we have a monster game on P500 called Battle for Sicily. I don't think that game is going to get play tested the way that like a Euro game would get play tested. I know it's not going to get tested the way that a Euro game would get tested, where you have a play test form and people play test it and then they write out all this stuff. Instead, what happens is some of the scenarios get played more often and players look for things that don't seem right with the model. So in a game like that, which is a big monster hex encounter game, you're looking for things like, does supply rules tend to put units out of supply where they shouldn't be? Does movement let units move farther than they ought to? Does it make sense that this army is able to defeat that army? Do battles happen as frequently as I expect them to? And asking those kinds of questions and tweaking the parameters of the model so that those things line up tends to solve the balance problems with those games over time. Now, that said, nobody is playing Battle for Sicily for balance, right? They're playing it for the sprawling narrative, the story it tells, the scope, the ambition. So yeah, that in that sense, playtesting has a different function and a different mode for a lot of our really like our big, long, sprawling games. As those things scale down and you start to talk about shorter games or more more abstract games like, you know, like Battle Line or Welcome to Centerville or even Dominant Species, those get playtested a different way. They are playtested for balance. They are playtested for victory outcomes and much more traditionally.
Oh, that's really interesting. I always did wonder about that. So when something goes wrong, like when you have to issue replacement counters and when, you know, there's, you know, you have to do errata on BGG, is that also something that the developer is partially taking on? And also, you know, I'm sure it doesn't feel good, but like, how do you respond to that at this point? It's not your first rodeo. So,
yeah. So I'll tell you about my first rodeo because it's instructive. The first game that GMT printed that I worked on was Gandhi. And Gandhi has this really awful, but not that impactful errata, which is on the player aids for the Muslim League faction. It lists on the operations all, or sorry, on the special activities, all the, no, it's on the operations. On the operations, all the operations that the special activities can go with. So it has like an extra line of info that shouldn't be there. And as soon as you know that that line doesn't mean anything, you just ignore it. And it's like it goes away. So it has incredibly low impact on the game. But the first time, especially if somebody's never played a coin game, they look at that, it is so confusing until they are told, oh yeah, that shouldn't be there. And I remember going into Gene's office because we got an advanced copy at the weekend at the warehouse and we opened it up and somebody was playing it and they walked over to Bruce and I and they said, does this look right to you? And showed us the player aid and Bruce and I just both turned like white, all the blood drained out of our face. We're like, what are we going to do? And so we went and talked to Gene and Gene was like, yeah, well, okay, first of all, welcome to board game publishing. Like, you now are officially designer and developer because you have shipped something and look, the thing you shipped is broken. But I mean, it's kind of like you've never been a bartender until you've dropped a glass. Like it's that kind of thing. But he also immediately was like, okay, well, what do we need to do to make it so that people can actually enjoy the game? And it very quickly became apparent, like, well, what we need to do is we need to post the information so that people know to ignore that line. Do we need to create replacement stuff? Well, we can put it online. If it really bothers them, we can give them the ability to print out a replacement. But our number one priority was, can people play and enjoy this game? And the answer was yes. Like, yes, this should not stop someone from playing and enjoying the game. Now, there are games that we have published where that's not true. And so that's when you start to talk about, okay, well, how do we fix this and make it right? And Imperial Struggle would be a good example of that. Like there were mistakes on the cards and some helpers on the board that were materially misleading. And so we wanted to make sure that that was fixed for players so that they could actually enjoy the game and not just constantly be thinking about, oh yeah, I have to remember that that's wrong. So it's a dance. There's an art to it. I think we've gotten better at just not shipping problems. That's been one thing that's happened is we've just seen the defect rate in our products going down. But the other thing is when you make a mistake, making it right in a way that serves your customers is important. And that's why we started doing our errata counter sheet, our annual sheet this year. And that counter sheet had counters on it from games from multiple years ago because we didn't really have enough mistakes in a year to fill the whole counter sheet, which is nice. So for 2024, I'm hoping it's a half sheet. And then for 2025, I'm hoping it's a quarter sheet and just keep working and improving and iterating from there. So that's how I think about it. You know, the thing at the end of the day that I think that if I could say one thing to people about this, it's that folks need to remember that if you have two components in a game, you only have one relationship between those two components, right? They relate to each other and that's the only relationship. But as you add every new component you add N minus one, the relationships are N minus one, right? What that means is that a game like a GMT game that is twice as complex as some other game is not twice as hard to get the errata out of. It's an exponential curve harder to get the errata out of. And so the the kind of complexity that our customers enjoy is also the reason the errata is in the game. And no matter how hard we try, the human brain is just not built to harness and to control that type of complexity. You know, my day job is a software developer, and software developers know this to be absolutely correct. Like, if you're a software dev, you have to write tools to help you deal with the complexity, and there are bugs in your tools that help you handle the complexity of the software you're writing. And so as a game developer, I don't have the ability to harness a computer the same way that I do at my day job. And that complexity can get out of control really fast. So a big part of development is reducing complexity, so you reduce the surface area for mistakes. But our customers enjoy complex board games. That's what they're buying from us. And part and parcel of those complex board games is going to be that the complexity sometimes escapes the harness that you've got it in. It slips its bit. You know, you got to give it the spurs and get it back in line. But that's how errata happens. That's where it really comes from. It's not necessarily carelessness on the part of the developer or the publisher as much as it is just, wow, sometimes these things are really hard to think about and obvious things slip through because your attention is elsewhere, or the model had side effects that you didn't think about. And that complexity also exists in just producing the games. Like, there's the printer, the artists, the editors, the developers, the designers. There's the logistics associated with it. You know, there's more to keep track of than I would ever have guessed when I first got into the industry. So none of that's an excuse. There shouldn't be any mistakes in the games, period. But that is why they're there.
I mean, it's good to know. I get anxious now that I've started to do editing. It's like, oh no, like, what am I going to let through?
Yeah, that's how it goes. I mean,
it's inevitable.
Like I said, you'll drop a glass and then it's like, okay, well, I didn't die. So now I know what not to do next time, and now I'm a full member of the club, you know. So that's how it works.
Fair enough. So, you know, you've gone into design as well. Do you have a developer for your designs? And like, how does that feel for you?
That's a great question. So for the Twilight Struggle game, Peter Evans is doing the development for that game. So Peter's a longtime Twilight Struggle player, and his insights into how the game engine actually works are really helpful, because sometimes people who have played the game so often actually have more insights than the designer themselves. Because as a designer, what I've noticed designers' pattern tends to be is they work on their game super intently, they get it out into the world, and then they don't want to look at it again for a while. And that can mean that by the time they come back around to look at it again, other people have become the expert on their game. And Peter's one of those people. He's played the game a ton. He knows it very well. There's also a pair of guys who worked on Twilight Struggle Red Sea who have been bugging Jason and I to get a copy of the new game. And they played Red Sea hundreds of times during playtesting. So people like that, those kind of like super playtesters, can often do a lot of development for you, even though they're not your developer. So it feels good. Like, it's nice to not carry that burden on my own. I don't know if I've ever fully really given it up. And we're not at the point, like, it'll be interesting to ask me that question again in a year when I've had to go through like maybe some of the more painful parts of development. Because right now we're still in the ideas. Like, we're still doing crazy stuff and trying it out to see what happens. Like, we have our core gameplay loop and we know how we want that to work. But it's like, well, how crazy can the card effects get? How weird can the effects on our tracks get? How do we really, like, are there other ways we want to represent Chinese influence in South Asia? And we're experimenting with those things. And that's much more design work than development work. Once it comes time to pin things down, I bet I'm going to be like the designer from hell. Like, I'll probably be the exact person that I hate working with the most. Just, you know, that's the way these things tend to go.
So I'll be real, you know, Night Witch's files have gone to Kevin and to Eno Tool, our artist and graphic designer. You know, David and I did not have a separate developer. But of course, Night Witch is a small game. So we tested it extensively ourselves. and then had playtesters give us feedback. But I mean, it's okay if you feel this way. Do you think that games need a developer, or at what size do you think they do?
No, I think, you know, especially when you have a co-designer, a lot of the things that a developer does are really having like a second pair of eyes, and co-designers can provide that. Also, like you kind of hinted at, like, there are games whose scope might be such that you don't need a developer. I think about games that are art pieces for that, especially. So I'm thinking about like Dan Bullock's The Gods Will Have Blood. Like, yeah. I'm not sure what a game developer would have added to that. And that's less a function of the scope of the game, although it is a very manageable scope, and more a function of the thing the game was trying to do. At least as I understood what the game was trying to do. I do think there probably is an inflection point where developers become less valuable in a smaller game. But I think that there might be another inflection point where they become valuable again, because you've gone so lean that every moving part becomes so important that you need help to make sure they're all correct. So I'm thinking about some of the micro games that are out there. Like, I'm thinking about a game like Love Letter. Mm. Like, I wonder, how did Love Letter get to be so tight? Was that entirely the designer? I don't know the story. Is that entirely the designer, or did somebody else step in at some point and say, we're going to take some of these edges off and refine some of the things to make it smoother and tighter? I would love to know, but I think that can be really hard. Like, my experience has been that less complex games, when you want to try to make a simple game that still has a high degree of engagement with a player, that can be a really big challenge. And that's where having a team is actually a lot more helpful.
Interesting. So if you have, you're talking about kind of expressing what a designer thinks, you know, maybe going back to a designer and telling them that something doesn't quite say what they think that they were saying. What happens when they disagree with you, and who gets the final say?
Yeah. So my rule is the designer wins, because we brought the designer in. We wanted the designer's game. So at the end of the day, when we sign a contract with the designer, we're saying, we want your vision. We want your thesis. We want to tell the story you want to tell. And if we disagree on what that is, the designer gets the trump card. That said, my goal is not to tell them, it's to persuade them. So I'm not going to a designer and saying, I think this tells the wrong story. I'm going to the designer and saying, hey, I had a feeling like this was wrong. So here's what I did. I went and I got these people to play it, and this is what they said they think this means. So, you know, like, how do we fix this perception? How do we fix this experience? And I've never had a designer tell me, oh, 10 people thought that this said the opposite of what I wanted it to. Well, I'm not going to change it. Like, that's just never happened. So maybe we just work with really great people. But I think that game designers tend to be thoughtful people, and they tend to be open to ideas. That's why they're doing game design. And so that means that if you come to them and say, I don't think this does what you mean it to, they are curious and they go, well, why do you say that? What makes you feel that way? And it opens a dialogue.
Nice. So have you ever, been overridden on something that just really hurt? And how did you handle it? It's okay if you can't tell us the details, but I would be interested.
No, I haven't. I have been told by a designer that they would go along with a change, but they thought I was wrong. Ooh. And that game came out, and I'm not going to say what game it was or who the designer was, but they have since told me that I was correct. So that felt good. I think there's definitely places where I've had development instincts and the designer has talked me out of them, but again, that's much more of like a dialogue situation, right? And I would say those things have definitely, there's definitely been cases where the designers have said, no, I think this is the way I want it to be, and the game has come out and it's been fine, it's been lauded. The most common case is that I point something out and the designer says, no, this is the way I want it to be. And I say, okay. And then the game comes out and people point out what I said. And the designer says, well, that's how I want it to be. And then other people say, yes, I'm glad it's that way. And there's just a difference of opinion because of taste.
Right.
And at the end of the day, I'm never going to push a designer to overrule something or to like change something because it's not my taste. If I'm going to them and saying, I think you need to make a change, it's because I think there's an outcome for the player that is not desirable. Right. Not just right. that, well, some people won't like this.
So this also sounds like, you know, you talk about being persuasive about, you know, choosing your words carefully. You work with a lot of different people, and I feel like that makes you probably an expert at giving and receiving feedback. So what are some of your personal strategies for that and tips for people who are commenting on games, playtesting games, you know, looking at each other's designs?
Yeah.
What are some of your road tested rules for that?
That's a really cool question. I was also a manager for 10 years, so giving feedback was like my bread and butter, like every day at work. So I think about this a lot, and I'm pretty passionate about it. I think as a designer, learning to receive feedback is very important. And so what I would say to that is, like, first of all, like, your number one job is to understand, not to refute. So it doesn't matter whether or not in a playtest that gamer walks away from the table and says, I hated that game. What matters is that you understand why they felt the way they did. And so if they walk away and they say, I hated that game, and you have no idea why, then that playtest was a waste. So as a designer, you should be curious. You should be asking questions. You should be understanding what kind of games they like. Why would they say that they didn't like this? What was it about their experience that was positive or negative? And asking good questions is the difference between a great playtest and an awful one. And by the way, I think that's why in-person playtests are so important, because you can have an interactive conversation with someone and you can say, okay, well, how did you feel about the game? And they say, I didn't like it. You say, why? Well, because I thought that this thing in the game was useless. Well, I'd be interested in thinking why you think it's useless. Like, what is it about that made you think it was useless? Is there a way it could have been more useful? Did you think it was useless, or did you not understand how to use it? And getting into that with people is really important. So as a designer, there's a lot to think about there. As a developer giving feedback, I think one really important thing is to remember that, like, you're dealing with a person. And so, you know, you are not dealing with a predictable system. Like, what I mean by that is, you don't know what's going on with that person when you chose to give them that feedback. So I might call, you know, Gene on the phone and say, Gene, I need to give you feedback about your game. And he is in some head state where he can't hear it. And so the first thing that I've started doing in every conversation is I've started out by saying, first of all, I always call people on the phone if I need to give them constructive feedback. Giving that via email is just, it's completely impersonal. They can't hear my voice. They can't hear the tone of voice I'm using. They have no human indication to go along with that feedback. And I mean, I learned that the hard way. Like, there was a designer that I needed to give some negative, like, feedback to, and I did it via email. And that was an absolute mistake. And I should never have done that, because it didn't let me convey that I actually cared. It just came across as like, oh no, I don't care about you. I don't care about this. And so I've learned, my very first manager was an old brand guy from Procter & Gamble. He'd been there for years. And he told me, if you really want to communicate with someone, you have to pick up the phone. And so email's great for information exchange, but if you want to communicate, pick up the phone. So that's number one. Number two is, I always ask at the beginning of the call, is this a good time for me to give you some feedback on your game? And if they say no, we don't do it. And even just asking helps put people in a position of being less defensive. And sometimes people need that. They need to prepare themselves, like, oh, okay, we're about to have a feedback conversation. Cool. I'm going to put my curiosity hat on instead of just being offended by being what's said, you know? And I think that those two things have served me super well. Obviously, like, being sensitive to what people, you know, their priors might be or what else is going on in their life is always really important, but sometimes you can't know. And just that act of asking, is this a good time, can be really, really powerful. So yeah, those would be my big things, is like, curiosity is king when you're trying to get feedback.
So I've learned to be afraid when your name pops up on the phone, and also that I would be terrible at feedback because I'm a millennial and I don't do phone calls.
Yeah, right? That's I mean, you're not wrong. Feedback in the 21st century is going to be an interesting thing. So, and everybody should be scared if my name pops up on their phone. It's a bad day if that happens.
All right. So I have one more kind of meaty question before we just kind of go into some fun stuff at the end. And it's that, so I know that you've done some solo modes. You talked about a system for doing solo for coin. I know that you did the solo for Twilight Struggle Red Sea. Are you a solo gamer yourself? And what mindset goes into making GMT solo modes specifically?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yes, I play solo games. My introduction to solitaire gaming came from Mike Berticelli. I was working on Tank Duel, and I got frustrated at playing it two-handed. Because it's a hand management game, so it's not the most solo friendly game,
right?
And I actually dreamt about how to do a solo system for it, and I woke up at 3 a.m. and I went and got my laptop, and I was sitting in bed working on it. My wife was like, "Would you go do that somewhere else, please?" But I couldn't help it; it was compulsive. And I called Mike the next day, and I told him, "Here's what I want to do. I have this thing figured out." And he's like, "That's great. You should absolutely work on that. Also, you should probably know what else is out there, because you're working in a vacuum and it shows." So he and I got on Vassal and played Comancheria, which he had just finished working on with Joel Toppin. And that blew my mind. Just absolutely blew my mind. I'd never seen some of the mechanics that were in that game with pulling cubes out of a bag and chits out of a cup and that kind of stuff. That's not that common in solo games outside of wargaming.
Yeah.
And then we played some coin, and I saw the coin bots, and I was like, okay, this is maybe a little more familiar with the flowcharts and everything. And I went deep down that rabbit hole. So I was just super into it for a very long time. And I mean, I still am. I love Jerry White's games, the Enemy Coast series, especially. I've been playtesting Infernal Machine. That's super fun. I love Joel's solo games. I really love Fields of Fire and John Butterfield's solo games. So I play a lot of solo stuff now. And I play the solo modes for all of the Euro games that I can get my hands on. So like Morten Patterson's stuff, the Automa Factory. I love what he does. I love his philosophy of solo development. When I was first doing solo design, I'd done a couple things, and then I ran into his blog series on BGG where he explains his kind of Automa philosophy. And I was like, yes, this is exactly what I want my games to be like. So I think about that all the time when I design. And I love to design solo games because of two reasons. First is, I just recognize that a lot of our gamers play games for the experience of the game much more than the competitiveness. They're playing for narrative. Cole Worley talks about this with Root, when he had the moment where he was like, oh, the Root bots are narrative supports for solitaire players. They're not primarily competitive opponents, although some people play for that reason. And I had the same experience when I was working on solo bots, where I had this moment of like, oh, I really just want the satisfying experience of being able to have this game out in front of me. So when I do a solo bot, that's what I think about. When I did Red Flag Over Paris, the question was, how do I make it feel as much as possible like the two-player game, even though it's not going to be the two-player game? That's the first reason. The second reason is, I truly believe that doing solitaire game development makes the multiplayer game better. And I think it does that by stress testing the engine and the core gameplay loops, and helping identify what it is about the game that is core and fun and essential, and what's secondary. And so at GMT, with GMT1, we've started pushing some of that solo design earlier in the process. With coin, we do it at the end because we have a system. So Bruce Mansfield designed this card-based system we call the Jacquard system. And it's applicable to like anything that uses the basic coin mechanics. When you make a new coin game, you're not reinventing the coin engine. So we can do this at the end because we're building on known ground. But when you have a game, there's a game that we're gonna announce this month. And it's from Matthias Kramer. And the game is super fun, and we're gonna add solo to it. And we want solo development to start now, because it's going to help inform and polish the game as we go through development. We don't want to wait until development is done and then have solo come in and see, oh, actually, this isn't working the way that we thought it was. And solo revealed that. So now we have to go back and restart some part of development, right? We don't want to do that. So, and that happens. That happened with Red Dust Rebellion. We were working on the coin bots for Red Dust Rebellion at the end, and some balance issues came out through the bot development. And we thought we had fixed that problem. We hadn't. So we had to go through another round of playtesting and balance checking to make sure that it was good and get it done. And then it just, you know, it takes time.
Oh, man. I feel like this might be a whole separate conversation, but I know you have a hard stop today. So first off the question, what have you been playing recently that's bringing you personally a lot of joy?
The Imperium Classics and Imperium Legends game. I have just absolutely had a blast with that. I love how asymmetrical everything is, and the solo mode, and that's a lot of fun.
Fantastic. And if people want to follow your activities online, where can you be found?
So I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Motti Normsby, which is the most ridiculous high school joke that has never gone away. Motti Normsby was a homecoming queen at The Ohio State University. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. She was also a Holstein cow. And when I was 12 years old, I thought this was the funniest thing in the universe. And so it became my handle everywhere. And it has never gone away. So yep, Motti Normsby on your platform of choice, and you have found me.
Fantastic. Jason, thank you so much for coming on. This has been an awesome conversation, and I hope we have another one when you're a few games deep so we can see how you're feeling about the development.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much again. And then everybody out there, please like, subscribe, comment, ask questions, and most of all, happy gaming.